managing not to break down.
Is the tyre pressure even all the way around?
Perfect.
It could be the exhaust.
Just had a new one fitted.
Dirty spark plugs?
No.
Must be the shock.
No.
Battery?
No lights on.
Air filter?
Don't know.
Distributor?
What is that? You don't know?
No.
Jason Burns, father figure on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
I spy with my little eye something beginning with C.
Car.
Well done.
In Tuesday night's Comedy Club at 10:30.
Now, our dangerous visions continue this week on 4 Extra with the second episode of Lord of the Flies. In part one, Ralph, Piggy and Jack are amongst a group of schoolboys who survive a plane crash and find themselves marooned on a desert island. Now, after weeks of no contact from the outside world, the boys are learning to look after themselves and Ralph is appointed leader, although his authority is tested and the tensions mount.
I sent the others back hours ago. Why aren't they helping?
They go off swimming like Roger, or picking fruit. How am I supposed to make them do anything?
Oh, want me to leather them, dear? Now I'm home.
Jack, we've all got to...
Got to? What?
I'm sick of this!
Lord of the Flies, made especially for 4 Extra, continuing Saturday night at 11.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Coming up in 15 minutes, Harold Pinter begins to narrate our three-part adaptation of the classic Victorian story of New Grub Street. In the meantime, in today's extract from Radiohead, first broadcast in 2009, the author John Osborne continues his exploration of the radio stations of Britain with a visit to the offices of the Radio Times. The reader is Lee Ingleby, but we begin with the words of our first Director General, Lord Reith.
Broadcasting is a development with which the future must reckon, and reckon seriously. Here is an instrument of almost incalculable importance in the social and political life of the community, in affairs national and international.
In 1923, the Radio Times was an immediate success, with a weekly circulation that soon exceeded 600,000. When my dad brought the Radio Times home every Tuesday, it provided a new sense of optimism in our house. No matter how bad school had been that day, we had something to look forward to. My sister and I would be excited about fresh programmes on offer, never-before-seen episodes of Neighbours, pages of film reviews the week mapped out ahead of us in a pristine, glossy magazine. By the end of the week, the corners were dog-eared, the staples were hanging on a thread. The crossword wrongly filled in, and it lay neglected as soon as the next shinier, glossier issue was out. The most exciting addition was always the bumper Christmas special, with a festive drawing of a snowman, Santa, mistletoe, or Del Boy. No matter how much tinsel there was in our living room at home, regardless of how many fairy lights were on trees down our road, how many times I'd heard Slade and Cliff Richard, for me, it was always when I saw the festive edition of the Radio Times resting on a chair in our living room that I was hit with the realisation that it was Christmas again. So here it is, Merry Christmas, everybody's having fun. It's real to the future
now, it's only just begun. Over the years, the publication has become a national institution, and to be featured on its cover is as much a status symbol as being asked to appear on Desert Island Discs or being honoured by the Queen. Past front covers of the Radio Times display a history of broadcasting. You can watch the ageing process of those famous enough to have graced the front cover several times. Terry Wogan, Delia Smith, Jonathan Ross, Deirdre Barlow. The publication has lived through wars and strikes, and has been at the centre of massive world changes, including the invention of television. After a speculative email, I am invited to meet its editor, Jill Hudson, to talk about her involvement with radio. I ask Alan Medlicott for the day off, and he checks his diary, scratching his head like a countdown contestant during the conundrum. "Do you need to know now?" he asks. I don't know whether to let him know I never really do anything at work, that my continued employment is baffling. With the date Hudson suggested 2 weeks away, I tell Alan Medlicott he can get back to me. It seems bizarre that it's easier to arrange a meeting with the editor of the Radio Times than to get someone to cover my data input for one day. I arrive at BBC Worldwide and I'm escorted from the reception desk, up the stairs, along the corridors lined with celebrated RT covers, Stephen Fry, Paul McCartney, Doctor Who, Pudsey Bear. We walk through the open-plan offices and into a little room where the Radio Times radio critic Jane Anderson is waiting with Jill Hudson. After I've plucked my dictaphone and a list of questions from my bag, they ask me the not unreasonable question of who I am. "What's your connection with radio?" Jane asks, once the introductions have been dealt with. "I listen all the time," I tell her. "I listen to a different radio station every day, and I'm trying to learn about people that work in radio." "Okay," Jill says. She seems to accept my explanation. I begin with my first question. "To what extent has digital radio changed your listening patterns?" "For me, not at all," Jane Anderson tells me. 55% of people listening to the radio are aged 55 or older. They like to be able to book an appointment with a certain show. Schedulers are very aware of the listening patterns of the majority of the audience, hence putting front row on after the archers. That way it creates thousands of extra listeners. She goes on to describe how picking and choosing your radio programmes in a different technological world denies the possibility of finding programmes by accident. People like the eclectic mix. They like doing the ironing, not knowing what's going to come on next. "Do you think radio gets enough media coverage?" I ask. "Don't get me started," Jane says, laughing. "We have been the poor relation for a long time. One of the issues we have at the magazine is how difficult it is to produce a front cover relating to radio. When someone is at a newsstand, the decision to purchase is taken in less than 2 seconds. You must have an immediately identifiable face. There aren't as many instantly identifiable figures on radio as there are on television for obvious reasons. What is very interesting to me," Jill says, "is that you don't have to look back too many years to when viewing figures for some of the soaps would be 20 million plus. 24 million viewers watched To the Manor Born one Christmas. You can see why television commanded such attention. Now look at the figures. People say a show is a success if it attracts around 5 million. Compare that with the listening figures for radio, and they're pretty much matching TV figures now. The afternoon play can pull in around 2 million. Afternoon television shows will be thrilled at that kind of response. Surely there is a reason now to give radio a bigger share of the limelight. What about national newspapers? How well do they cover radio?" "It's non-existent in the tabloids," Jane says, spitting the T-word out like corked wine. "Broadsheets do a good job, but the radio section is always tucked away." According to Jane, "One of the really lovely things about this job, and it sounds like I'm name-dropping now, but I've had people like Helen Mirren phone me in my office. Big stars would not normally speak to the likes of me, but because she's appearing in a play on Radio 4, she's phoning me from Hollywood and is so enthusiastic. People have a genuine affection for Radio 4. I have already been with Jane and Jill longer than I anticipated and don't want to outstay my welcome, so I thank them, and they give me a copy of next week's magazine, hot off the press. I head to a nearby cafe to get some lunch. It's the 27th of February, 2008. The bookshelves start shaking. The walls wobble. My cup of tea does a hiccup. It's 1 in the morning. I check the windows to make sure no one is trying to break in. I double lock the door, and when I am satisfied there are no men in balaclavas trying to steal my valuables, I switch on the radio as I clean my teeth. "If you felt the earthquake, please phone in," Ian Collins urges on his Talk Sport programme. "Earthquake?" I swirl and spit. Soon Collins is using words like tremor and Richter scale, and I realise that the thing making my books bounce on their shelves was not subsidence or terrorists, but what the guys in San Fran call a quake. A man from Birmingham phones in. "It was so loud, I nearly fell out of bed." A lady in South London calls. "I thought someone was breaking in. My dogs won't stop barking.
It is late at night and I want to go to sleep, but I still haven't made tomorrow's sandwiches. As I get a slab of cheddar from the fridge, more information filters through.
The earthquake's epicentre is Market Raisin, 20 miles south of Hull, Collins announces.
The cheese grater drops out of my hand. Cheddar shavings fall to the floor. I grew up 10 miles from Market Raisin. Lived there until I was 18 when I went to university in Norwich. It's where my mum and dad still live. They won't like being at the epicentre of an earthquake. They don't like inconvenience.
I switch off Ian Collins in favour of revving up my computer and listening to BBC Radio Humberside online to get more localised information. The only time I have ever listened to Radio Humberside was on the rare winter mornings when I woke up and saw the roads covered in snow. My sister and I would listen, waiting for our school to be mentioned on the list of school closures for the day. I haven't listened since. In fact, it is surprising that the station is still going. Humberside, as a county, ceased to exist in 1994. Local MP Michael Brown said he wanted the word Humberside to be expunged from the English language. Listening to reports coming in, it seems the whole region was almost expunged about 10 minutes ago. Steve Redgrave is on the air. The radio presenter, that is, not the former Olympic rower. I'm only assuming this. He is talking to a representative from Humberside Fire and Rescue Service who urges people not to phone the emergency services unless they feel there is a genuine problem. The earthquake shook 3 minutes before the end of Redgrave's late-night show, just as the station was tidying up bits and pieces, preparing to link up to Radio 5 Live's output for the night. It was decided that Redgrave would stay on air for as long as necessary, that this was a time when people would be switching on their radios for information that the station needed to serve the community. It seems I wasn't the only one to seek Radio Humberside for reassurance.
Everything was shaking. You could feel the bed trembling as well.
This is apparently an event across the northern part of England. We've got a few people beavering away to find out some details.
He is the reassuring presence, the local voice that people need in this type of situation. And the emails and phone calls are clearly appreciative of his overtime.
Just to say that we are BBC Radio Humberside. Thank you for tuning our way. If you chose to tune to us this morning for the very latest information, the calls have been flooding into us this morning so far. So thank you for your time on that one. If you do know of any elderly people in the area and you think they might be a bit worried, a bit upset, you know, do the neighbourly thing. Just knock on the door and say, are you all right? You know, check that your own family's okay, that sort of thing.
I decide not to phone my mum and dad, though. Sleeping through an earthquake only to be woken by a phone call is the kind of irony that happens regularly in our house. Bennett Simpson from the British Geological Survey in Edinburgh is in touch with the show. The preliminary information from our instruments is a measurement of 5.3 on the Richter scale, which is a considerable amount, Simpson says. It has been felt throughout the UK and it is definitely a quake, not a tremor, he confirms. It was timed at 0:56 this morning and is the largest UK earthquake since 1984 in North Wales when it measured a 5.4. In a worldwide context, this is very small, but for the UK, it is huge. Redgrave is now growing comfortable updating news, saying, "This is BBC Radio Humberside," in his newsflash voice, telling people tuning in that something has happened. Some callers describe slightly post-apocalyptic scenes, tiles slipping off roofs, animals howling, neighbours standing on the road in their dressing gowns and slippers, shaking their heads, shrugging their shoulders. It's already 2:30 a.m. Hazel is on air in Scunthorpe. I looked out at window, but no one came out onto the street, but I think that's because people are antisocial in Scunthorpe, she says with a chuckle. As the calls continue to come in, it seems that after the initial concern and confusion, people have started to settle down and are responding in a very English way. I was terrified, then I had a cup of tea. As 3 a.m. approaches, it is clear that the panic has calmed down. Fears of repercussions have subsided and people are going back to sleep. There is nothing more to add. Redgrave's work here is done. He summarises the night's action, recaps key information, thanks people who have been in touch and wishes his listeners well. I turn off my computer, go back to bed, and look forward to my 4 hours sleep.
Part 3 of Radiohead by John Osborne was read by Lee Ingleby and abridged and produced by Jill Waters. Tomorrow, Musings on Pirate Radio with a nice piece of archive of John Peel at the same time, 2:45.
How come you have black curtains everywhere?
After 5 years as an evacuee in America, Rusty returned to a war-ravaged Britain.
They're blackout curtains. We had to have them to stop the lights from showing if bombers came over.
A 12-year-old who doesn't recognise her home or her family.
Nobody wants me here. Mum is more interested in fixing engines than seeing me again.
Michelle Magorian's award-winning story.
I have a right to my say, same as you.
You're a child, and you will do as you are told.
Back Home on BBC Radio 4 Extra, on Sunday morning at 9 and again at 5.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Wes Butters at 3, drama next with a classic that's been described as penetrating and powerful. And then the 4 o'clock show is on. Mel today is celebrating slowly World Sauntering Day with the next episode of Terry Pratchett's A Hatful of Sky. She'll be smelling the roses with gardening guru Monty Don's Inheritance Tracks and hearing World Service science presenter Gareth Mitchell's rubbish karaoke singing. You might want to have some earplugs ready for that. From 4. Now, for the rest of this week, we're running something we've not heard on 4 Extra before. New Grub Street, a novel by George Gissing, first published in 1891. It's set in London's literary and journalistic circles in the 1880s. The two central characters are Edwin Reardon, yes, we have heard that name before, a talented but unsuccessful novelist, and a young, cynical, go-getting writer called Jasper Milvain, who's not completely scrupulous about writing and its purpose in the late Victorian era.
New Grub Street by George Gissing, dramatised by Tony Ramsay, with Harold Pinter as the narrator. Episode 1.
From his desk, Edwin Reardon looked out onto the damp rooftops of Maida Vale. It was the novelist's habit to begin the main work of the day at 9 and work late into the evening. But this morning, he was at his desk before breakfast. The book had slowed. Not for the first time, he found himself wondering if a few days' respite from London might not be all he needed to unlock his story. But he dismissed the thought. For the man who labours in the valley of the shadow of books, there could be no rest. Driving all idea of the reviving country air from his mind, he dipped his pen and began to write.
Hmm. 8 o'clock. There's a fellow being hanged in London at this very moment.
Jasper, how could you? That's horrible.
Why on earth should it be horrible?
I'm sure he didn't mean to sound that way, did you, Jasper?
No. I can either be miserable for the poor wretch, which would do neither of us any good, or I can be grateful that I'm sitting here with a fresh egg and some excellently buttered toast instead of accompanying Mr. Ketch onto the gallows.
And a literary man must be interested in such things, I suppose.
Exactly. Might make a few hundred words for the wayside. A comparison, from a culinary point of view, of that gentleman's breakfast and my own.
That would not be literature.
Literature nowadays is a trade, Dora. I'm afraid the market will decide, not you. Is there any marmalade?
It's not just what I think. Mr. Reardon would say the same.
I think he probably would.
Of course he would. If you're really going to follow a literary career, you should try to be more like him.
Reardon will end up in penury. I will not.
How can you say that? On Neutral Ground was a wonderful novel and a great success.
It was, and he followed it with The Optimist, which was neither. I told him he wasn't the kind of man to keep up literary production on a paying basis. Edwin Reardon is the old type of unpractical artist. I am the literary man of 1882. This toast really is uncommonly good.
That seems a strange way to speak of someone you like, Jasper.
Well, Reardon is my greatest friend. And as soon as I get back to London, I shall call on him and tell him so. But he makes too large a demand on fate.
You're jealous.
Why should I be jealous of Reardon?
Because he's married, successful, and has a beautiful wife. And you are single and have hardly published anything at all.
In 10 years, I'll be making 1,000 a year. Then I shall marry a woman with a decent income. I will certainly not make the mistake Reardon has made. Amy is beautiful and intelligent. But a man in his position should have taken a working girl...